Psychopolitics, ladies and gentlemen, is the art and science of asserting and maintaining dominion over the thoughts and loyalties of individuals, officers, bureaus, and masses, and the effecting of the conquest of enemy nations through mental healing. This I quoted directly from the Communist Manual of Instructions of Psychopolitical Warfare. Is there a method behind all this subterfuge and deception? Tradition might be a better word. The use of Machiavellian-style manipulations has been around for centuries, but it appears to have gone from an art to a science in this century. As socialist philosopher Bertram Russell once said of mass psychology, quote, although this science will be diligently studied, it will be rigidly confined to the governing class. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. The use of what Stalin's secret police chief, Lavrenty Beria, termed psychopolitics, was covered in the January 1995 issue of Relevance magazine. Psychological Warfare in America was the title of the article. The above quoted Russian textbook on psychopolitics was exposed to the public by former communist American Kenneth Goff, who testified before Congress in 1939 about communist subversion in this country. And if you'd like a reference to that particular piece, see Volume 9 of the 1939 House Committee on Un-American Activities. In the manual, a key element of brainwashing was revealed. Constant defamation of the target population. The manual may well be one of the most vicious political tracts ever written, making Mein Kampf look like a paperback on pop psychology. To give a bit of the flavor of the psychopolitics manual, here, ladies and gentlemen, are a few excerpts. Quote, one of the first and foremost missions of the psychopolitician is to make an attack upon communism and insanity synonymous. It should become the definition of insanity, of the paranoid variety, that a paranoid believes he is being attacked by communists. Thus, at once, the support of the individual attacking communism will fall away and wither. You can find that on page 25. Propaganda should continue and stress the rising of insanity in a country. The entire field of human behavior for the benefit of the country can, at length, be broadened into abnormal behavior. Thus, anyone indulging in any eccentricity, particularly the eccentricity of combating psychopolitics, could be silenced by the authoritative opinion on the part of a psychopolitical operative that he was acting in an abnormal fashion. You can find that on page 33. The educational programs of psychopolitics must at every hand seek out the levels of youth who will become the leaders in the country's future and educate them into the belief of the animalistic nature of man. This must be made fashionable. They must be taught to frown upon ideas, upon individual endeavor. They must be taught above all things that the salvation of man is to be found only by his adjusting thoroughly to this environment. And you can find that on page 43. Religion must be made synonymous with neurosis and psychosis. That's on page 44. Degradation and conquest are companions. However, degradation can be accomplished much more insidiously and much more effectively with consistent and continual defamation. Defamation is the best and foremost weapon of psychopolitics on the broad field. You'll find that on page 41. The populace must be brought into the belief that every individual within it who rebels in any way, shape or form, against efforts and activities to enslave the whole, must be considered to be a deranged person whose eccentricities are neurotic or insane and who must have at once the treatment of a psychopolitician. That's on page 42. An optimum condition in such a program of degradation would address itself to the military forces of the nation and bring them rapidly away from any other belief than that the disobedient one must be subjected to mental treatment. An enslavement of a population can fail only if these rebellious individuals are left to exert their individual influences upon their fellow citizens, sparking them into rebellion, calling into account their nobilities and freedoms. unless these restless individuals are stamped out and given into psycho-political operatives early in the conquest, there will be nothing but trouble as the conquest continues. That is also on page 42. The officials of the government, students, readers, partakers of entertainment, must all be indoctrinated by whatever means into the complete belief that the restless, the ambitious, the natural leaders are suffering from environmental maladjustments which can only be healed by recourse to psycho-political operatives in the guise of healers. Page 43. By thus degrading the general belief in the status of man, it is relatively simple, with cooperation from the economic salients being driven into the country, to drive citizens apart, one from another, to bring about a question of the wisdom of their own government, and to cause them to actively beg for enslavement. That may be found on page 43. Should any writings of psychopolitics come to view, it is only necessary to brand them a hoax and laugh them out of countenance. Thus, psychopolitical activities are easy to defend. Page 34. Now, for your information, you may obtain the book Brainwashing, a synthesis of the Russian textbook on psychopolitics from Robert Brock. That's Robert Brock, P.O. Box 15288. That's Robert Brock, P.O. Box 15288, Washington, D.C., 20003. Just send $5 to Robert Brock, P.O. Box 15288, Washington, D.C., 20003. Just send $5. Tell them you want Brainwashing, a synthesis of the Russian textbook on psychopolitics. Now, most Americans would find it hard to take these almost cartoonishly diabolical statements seriously. Edward Hunter, the man who coined the term brainwashing after he had witnessed it firsthand as a journalist in Red China, said as much before Congress on March 13, 1958. I quote, "The United States is the main battlefield in this Red War. We need only read what the communists themselves say, but we refuse to do so, exactly as we could not believe that Hitler meant what he said in Mein Kampf," end quote. It was during the McCarthy era, ladies and gentlemen, that the anti-communism equals insanity dictum began to enjoy mass propagation by not only political demagogues, but leaders in the fields of mental health and psychology. One brief example, in a chapter on mental hygiene, George S. Stevenson, M.D., of the National Association for Mental Health, wrote the following in his book, Education for Mental Health, in 1954, and I quote, "For example, a person who is continuously suspicious of others, who sees an enemy, perhaps a communist, lurking behind every acquaintance who differs from himself, is a person who is very unsure of himself. He will be apt to try to control the world about him in such a way that it will be least threatening," end quote. Now, folks, that was a fairly harmless example of the kind of soft-touch stereotyping directed at those who opposed communism. When this association between anti-communism and insanity is repeated ad nauseum until it resonates throughout society, what results is a subtle change in the public mindset. Soon, people who might have expressed these sentiments or opinions start to keep their thoughts to themselves. And before long, such discussions are considered beyond the pale of respectable conversation. Edward Hunter, who spent 2 years in the old OSS teaching psychological warfare countermeasures, told a congressional committee in 1958 that he first learned of the term brainwashing when, as a reporter in Asia, he spoke with a man who had escaped Red China. The man related the term "sigh now" or "wash brain," Hunter stated. "Whenever somebody said something the Peking government wouldn't like, a relative or friend was liable to say to him, 'Watch out, you'll get your brains washed.'" Isn't it amazing? But the Psychopolitics Manual was written in the 30s, and all this talk about communist subversion in this country was discredited, along with tail gunner Joe McCarthy, back in the 50s. Anyone who was afraid of a communist behind every bush was viewed as a paranoid, right? They're still doing that today. They call it McCarthyism. That's what they brand you with. Shame on you. You're finding communists. Well, the Washington Post, ladies and gentlemen, has had to admit that lo and behold, there actually were real live communists who penetrated the United States government hierarchy. Not just the exceptional Aldrich Ames Mole, but over 100 agents in many different agencies of the United States government. After years of keeping the information buried, the National Security Agency, NSA, finally released the fruits of its Venona program, which, according to the Post, produced intercepted, decoded Soviet spy messages with NSA notes identifying agents mentioned in code in the cables. The story was carried in a recent article by Michael Dobbs, which appeared in the March 6, 1996 Washington Post, a newspaper which has done much to ridicule anti-communists for decades. The agents identified in the documents include Lachlan Curry, a personal aide to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and May Price, the secretary to influential newspaper columnist Walter Lippmann. An agent known to the Soviets as Mlad was identified as Theodore A. Hall, who helped the Reds obtain the atomic bomb. Nevertheless, the Justice Department has refused to disclose why it did not prosecute Hall. Other agents working for the KGB included former War Department official William Ullman, former intelligence officials J. Joseph Julius and Jane Foster, Harold Glasser of the Treasury Department, George Silverman of the Air Force, Nathan Silvermaster of the Board of Economic Warfare, and Harry Dexter White of the Treasury Department. All of those were named by Elizabeth Bentley in her testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee. But you see, she was laughed off as a kook along with her reformed fellow traveler, Whitaker Chambers, who fingered Alger Hiss as a communist spy. Alger Hiss is responsible, almost single-handedly, for the authorship of the United Nations Charter, which, when placed side by side with the old Charter, I should say Constitution of the Soviet Union, they are almost identical. Coincidence, you say? Not on your life. Not on your life. Alger Hiss is also implicated in the Venona records just released. The Post quoted John Haynes, historian at the Library of Congress, who has written extensively about KGB spying in the United States, quote, "This will be painful to many historians. Bentley has been mocked in many books as a blonde spy queen. These documents support what she was saying," end quote. So the testimony of Elizabeth Bentley and Whitaker Chambers and tail gunner Joe McCarthy's cause for concern was correct after all. In fact, Joseph McCarthy was absolutely 100% right. And it was because he was stopped in his investigations and the communists and the Marxists were not rooted out of government that they were able, over the years, to take complete and utter control of every branch of bureaucracy within the United States of America. What was the extent of this high-level penetration at that time in history? Lance Gay of Scripps Howard News Service wrote, quote, "Transcripts of cables sent by KGB agents to Moscow in 1944 and 1945 were intercepted by United States cryptanalysts and indicate that more than 100 Soviet agents had infiltrated the State Department, Justice Department, War Department, Treasury Department, and even the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the Central Intelligence Agency." For reference, see the Detroit News, March 14, 1996, page 10A. So then again, doesn't this discussion amount to blatant McCarthyism? You see, in talking about this, aren't we politically incorrect? Isn't this a major boo-boo today? Aren't we in danger of being branded McCarthyites? Well, what do you think the respectable establishment in this country is engaging in by shamefully lumping homeschoolers and talk show hosts in with murderous terrorists? Of course, this doesn't make it right. What makes it right and necessary to candidly discuss all this is the facts, ladies and gentlemen, the facts. The truth. Seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free. Nothing else can do it. On March 1st, 1992, the same Washington Post had to admit that despite all the scorn and abuse heaped onto paranoid anti-communists for decades by that newspaper and scores of Eastern establishment liberals, the Soviet Union was, in fact, directly funding Gus Hall's Communist Party USA. Independent researchers had found proof among the documents opened by the archives of the former Soviet Union. And I wrote as much in my book many years ago. The files detailed the funds sent by the Soviet Union to its Communist Party set up around the world and included a 1987 letter from Gus Hall to Mikhail Gorbachev, which began, "Dear comrade, I don't like to raise the question of finances, but when the wolf is at the door, one is forced to cry out." Documents revealed that Gorbachev sent $2 million and Hall sent back a signed receipt. Of course, shortly afterward, Mikhail Gorbachev became Gorby and won the hearts and many minds of liberal Americans and later used funds raised by the Republican National Committee and big business to open a Western office of his Gorbachev Foundation inside the longest-standing United States Army base in history, the Presidio in San Francisco. Further evidence, ladies and gentlemen, that the laughing liberals of the last few decades have egg on their faces is provided by Harvey Clare, John Haynes, and Friedrich Firsoff's 1995 work entitled The Secret World of American Communism, which uses the Russians' own documents to show the extent of Soviet backing of communist activity in this country. So the question then becomes, if they had at least 100 agents in high-level posts back then that we knew about and that we know about now, how many do they have now when we no longer believe they're a threat? And how many did they have over the years that we have never known about and probably never will? Aldrich Ames occupied a very high post within the Central Intelligence Agency. Do you think it's a paranoid fantasy to imagine that there are those in still higher positions right now? Clare, Haynes, and Firsoff noted at the close of their book, and I quote, "Because Soviet intelligence archives remain closed, the activities described are but the tip of the iceberg, the now visible part of a much larger and still obscure secret world of American communism," end quote. Now, if that hasn't got you sitting on the edge of your chair, then I guess nothing ever will. Why isn't this kicking off a national debate and congressional investigations to determine the current extent of KGB subversion? Why isn't the press blaring this information on the front pages of every newspaper across the country? Well, because, you see, that would amount to McCarthyism. And besides, facts really don't mean much to people with closed minds who would rather believe something that is politically correct rather than look at the truth staring them right in the face. As Paul Greenberg of the Los Angeles Times Syndicate wrote about the NSA Venona files, and I quote, "The latest cache of documents will not convince them. True believers are not daunted by mere evidence. There is nothing here they cannot deny, dismiss, or explain away. History, like a good suit, can be made to fit. That is their faith, that nothing is immutable, even the past." Funny. I don't recall reading this news story in the New York Times. I must have missed it, or the Times did. End quote. Such is the effect of strategic psychological operations on the targeted nation's public opinion. This is why brainwashing expert Edward Hunter ridiculed the notion of a communist party, when it is in fact, he insisted, a communist psychological warfare organization. Former KGB insiders like Anatoly Golitsyn would tend to agree. Although we quoted him before, it's worth repeating the words of Russian KGB defector Yuri Besmenov, who discussed his former agency's efforts at ideological subversion, or what they called demoralization in America. In a 1989 video interview by author G. Edward Griffin, Besmenov explained, quote, "The key to understanding the blindness is seeing that government leaders, the press, educators, etc., appear to be functioning as a part of a gigantic conspiracy, not because they are all under a centralized discipline or control, but because they share the same foundational philosophy and beliefs, end quote. You see, this slow process actually changes the way we all respond to factual information. Most of it, that's demoralization, is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to a lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, ladies and gentlemen, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. You see, a person who is demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Bezmenov accurately described the intellectual invalids now masquerading as responsible journalists, bureaucrats, and elected representatives. He said, and I quote, "They are programmed to think and react to certain stimuli in a certain pattern. You cannot change their mind, even if you expose them to authentic information, even if you show them that white is white and black is black. You still cannot change the basic perception and their logic of behavior," end quote. Sad? No, ladies and gentlemen, it's not sad, it's tragic. And this may provide insight into the almost knee-jerk solutions to national problems, which are recycled despite overwhelming evidence that they do not work, and in many cases, even worsen the problem. Some examples? Violent crime? Well, we have violent crime. Let's pass gun control laws. Welfare fraud? Oh, well, let's fund more programs. AIDS? Oh, my goodness, let's pass out condoms and syringes. Russian treaty violations? Well, we'll send them more financial aid. We see the same rigorously conditioned responses by journalists or so-called experts to talk show callers who make the mistake of asking a question with conspiratorial overtones, no more capable of restraining themselves than Pavlov's dogs were of salivating. They blurt out that remarkably consistent refrain, quote, "That sounds like some kind of conspiracy theory," end quote. Of course, Ivan Pavlov rewarded his obedient canines. Likewise, the journalist who, shall we say, learns his lines well, continues to advance up the sleazy ladder of success, leaving his less compliant counterparts in the dust. And a similar process of natural selection was identified in Christopher Simpson's 1994 book called Science of Coercion, Communication Research in Psychological Warfare, 1945 to 1960. This book shows that those social science professors who did not play ball with the prevailing and overwhelmingly government-funded opinions in the field of psychological warfare were conditioned to comply or they were nudged out of prominence. Simpson writes, quote, "In sum, there were both positive and negative reinforcements for academics participating in U.S. psychological warfare projects. Among the perks, it is clear that use of government funding facilitated certain types of research and the winning of professional prestige that might not otherwise have been available. Among the pearls of nonconformity, quote, the price tag for scholars who refused to support the Cold War consensus could be quite high. Shunning by colleagues, firing, loss of tenure or prospects for promotion, FBI inquiries, hostile newspaper stories, or worse, even prominent academics were not exempt. FBI and U.S. military intelligence agents kept American Sociological Society conventions under surveillance in an effort to smoke out radicals. Charles Beard, the longtime dean of American historians and former president of the American Historical Association, was drummed out of the profession when he refused to readjust his work to the new political realities. Thank you. Listening to the Hour of the Time, I'm William Cooper, the man that President Clinton wrote in a White House memo is the most dangerous radio host in America, and Rush Limbaugh read it on the air in order to take the heat off of himself. Even though to this day he still bills himself as the most dangerous man in America, that proved him to be a liar. Why am I the most dangerous radio host in America, ladies and gentlemen? Because I tell the truth. Simply because I tell the truth. I document it. I back it up with sources so that you can go out and obtain the exact same documentation. Why did he call me the most dangerous radio host in America? Because I know that Bill Clinton is a communist, his wife is a communist, and they are destroying this country with their fellow travelers placed in key strategic locations throughout the bureaucracy of the United States of America and the individual states. How else could all this be happening to us? How else could this nation be coming apart at the seams? Why has all this been happening? You used to blame it on the Soviet Union, and you were right, because the leadership always came from there. The funding always came from there. But you might say, even if there are a few quixotic communists inside this country still trying to fight the revolution with psychopolitics, how can they pose a threat since communism itself has been dead since the end of the Cold War? Well, you could ask that if you haven't been paying attention and you really don't understand what's happening and you really haven't done any research other than tuning into the 6 o'clock news and listening to the lies from Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, Ted Koppel, Connie Chung, and all the others. You see, unfortunately, as crazy as it sounds, communism was never dead. If you read Mikhail Gorbachev's Perestroika, he told you in there, he told you the truth, that it is a scam to force the West to lower its guard. Communism is in the process of being resurrected right this moment, ladies and gentlemen, without rehashing all of our evidence. We refer you to the December 1995 issue of Relevance Magazine, Planning for the Soviet Reunion, the January 1996 issue, The Changing of the Guard, and the exhaustively documented Fall 1994 special report, The New Lies Strategy. See also Relevant March 1995, and hours and hours and hours of broadcasts of the Hour of the Time where I sat here and documented and read you the documents and the sources where you could get them over and over and over again for going on to 5 years now. The planning for a Soviet reunion continues apace with another big step in the left direction. On the Ides of March 1996, the Russian Parliament voted for a resolution denouncing the 1991 dissolution of the Soviet Union as illegal. This is viewed, ladies and gentlemen, inside Russia as being the prelude to the quickening process of reconsolidating the old Soviet Union. The press may banter about that it is fractured into independent states and ethnic territories that have all become democratic and are being led by great democratic leaders. A quick review of the background of those so-called democratic leaders reveals them to be lifelong staunch communists. There has been no changing of the guard. This process was almost matter-of-factly predicted by Anatoly Golitsyn in his 1984 book entitled New Lies for Old. Before old Gorby or his glasnost scam, also predicted by Golitsyn, had even appeared in the West. Of course, the reconstitution of the Soviet Union could never occur without the orchestrated sham breakup of the Soviet Union in the first place. Now that vast concessions have been extracted from the gullible West, and we are disarming and chopping our B-52 bombers into three parts in an Arizona desert, dismantling our Minuteman missiles and intercontinental ballistic missiles and destroying these missile sites. Oh, yes. Vast concessions have been extracted from the gullible West. Billions of dollars. We're beginning to see further evidence that Golitsyn was right all along. You see, the New York Times of March 22, 1996 revealed, and I quote, General Verinikov, who helped the abortive coup against Mikhail S. Gorbachev in 1991, warned an audience of Russian army officers last Saturday not to worry that Communist Party chief Mr. Zyuganov is, quote, sliding towards social democratic values, end quote. The general said the party still has a clear but unpublished plan, a clear but unpublished plan, a maximum program for restoring a socialist state which would be put into action after the elections, end quote. Maximum plan was the Bolsheviks' term for their long-term goals of creating a socialist world order. Maximum plan was the Bolsheviks' term for their long-term goals of creating a socialist world order, and the general's use of the phrase has stirred waves of shocked speculation among intellectuals and journalists. Why was Zyuganov's response to the general's comments? What was it? He said, quote, it was a slip of the tongue, Mr. Zyuganov said on Tuesday, insisting that there is no secret plan. And of course, I believe him, don't you? Naturally, the vast majority of well-educated readers of the New York Times were instantly reassured by Comrade Zyuganov's clarifying statements. These trusting souls know, beyond any doubt, that the Cold War is over and the Russians are all Democrats, even the communists. After all, ladies and gentlemen, they read it in the New York Times. Any doubt that the KGB psychopoliticians have a sense of humor was dispelled by the hilarious coup in August of 1991, in which the stone-faced plotters came down with bouts of flu and gave in to mighty Democrat Boris Yeltsin, appearing as himself in the unforgettable tank-mounting scene. There is no denying their gift for satire, not to mention showmanship. The only question is, how do they keep a straight face when delivering lines like Zyuganov's, quote, it was a slip of the tongue, end quote, or when their brilliant young comic actor Vladimir Zhirinovsky voiced his support for Pat Buchanan? Oh, man, I rolled on the ground. I almost died with laughter over that one. And when he did it, He granted his distractors one final embarrassing coup de grace with which to finish his candidacy, and he did it on purpose. Yes, folks, the KGB's Moscow troop has been turning in Oscar-caliber performances for 5 years, but remains largely undiscovered, not only by Hollywood talent scouts, but also by Western journalists. Or maybe the humor's just too dry for American tastes or perceptions. Maybe Americans have grown stupid. Even if the psychopolitics technique are being used by resurgent Russian communists, we won't be affected by it, is the strain I often hear. Not so fast there, buddy. The Philadelphia Inquirer's August 20th, 1995 Sunday magazine carried a cover story cheerfully titled Paranoid Politics, the Blurry Line Between Extremism and Madness. In it, we were introduced to Gerald Post, a professor of political psychiatry at George Washington University and the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency's Psychological Unit. I read this directly out of his biography. The professor tells us that paranoia is part of the human condition. It exists in some measure, in all of us. Yes, and it will exist in quite a few more of us when the full implications of political psychiatry sink in. Although the Inquirer doesn't admit it, the concept of a psychiatrist treating one's political views raises the specter of Soviet psychiatrists treating dissidents. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't it sound an awful lot like the above quotes from that outdated psychopolitical manual from the 30s? But oddly enough, the Inquirer article provides the following little curio. Post is, quote, near completion of a book called The Psychopolitics of Hatred. And I'll be the first one to let you know, ladies and gentlemen, when that book comes out. Ex-CIA man Post, and I've got to tell you right now, there is no such thing as an ex-CIA man. Never was, is not now, and never can or will be. There is no ex-CIA man. Post is not the only doctor dabbling in political psychiatry. You see, the March 5th, 1996 edition of the Detroit News carried a column by psychiatrist turned neoconservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, which appeared under the heading The Paranoid Fantasies of Pat Buchanan. And after a long list of half-truths in which he attempts to show how simply crazy it is to think of the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization as threats to United States sovereignty, he closes the piece with the following line, quote, when I was a psychiatrist, I had patients with similar fantasies. Some even thought they were president. Not one, however, actually ran for the office, end quote. So Dr. Krauthammer has apparently returned to clinical practice as a psychopolitician, and he has diagnosed patient candidate Buchanan as suffering from paranoia. Only now he is sharing his patient's diagnosis with his readers across the country. But his disregard for doctor-patient confidentiality is surpassed by an even more reckless disregard for the facts, ladies and gentlemen. For instance, Krauthammer states, quote, the notion that the United Nations, a moribund, bankrupt, entirely dependent organization, threatens American sovereignty and independence is simply crazy, end quote. And he should know. He is, after all, a psychiatrist. Still, the notion that an organization which has gone from an international joke to the recognized arbiter of world peace and security in the space of less than 6 years is entitled to at least a little respect. And whether the good doctor realizes it or not, the world body has gained more than a little respect from our own military brass. The April 1995 edition of Special Warfare, the official quarterly of the United States Army John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, exposes the prevailing view of the United Nations within our military establishment. Listen carefully. The cover story is entitled Ambushing the Future and is written by James J. Schneider, a professor of military theory at the School of Advanced Military Studies, United States Army Command and General Staff College, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Schneider predicts that The future will be dominated by a resurgent force that will change the nature of both the nation state and the national security system. Do you have any guess as to what that resurgent force might be? Well, folks, Schneider continues. He says, in other words, to learn from the past, we must anticipate the future. And the future will be dominated by a single overwhelming presence, the United Nations. The resurgence and the growing influence of the United Nations will not only affect our soldiers, but may change the very structure of the nation state, end quote. Krauthammer laughs at the notion of a United Nations threat against United States sovereignty, while this army expert accepts our domination as a done deal. In addition, the United States Army even court-martialed a young medic named Michael New for refusing to wear the uniform of Krauthammer's moribund, entirely dependent organization. You see, the problem with articles like Schneider's and the case of Michael New is that they tend to undermine Dr. Krauthammer's diagnosis of Pat Buchanan's paranoia. Could it be that the good doctor is spending more time reading Psychology Today than he is reading Special Warfare and other journals that might better assist him in what his fellow psychiatrists call reality testing? He snidely notes that the United Nations has become a pliable, occasionally useful creature of American foreign policy. We send it into briar patches we wish to stay out of, Bosnia, for example. This boob forgets that we weren't able to stay out of the Bosnian briar patch. Right now, this moment, as I speak, there are over 20,000 United States troops and 17,000 support personnel over there in Bosnia right now working for NATO. Krauthammer, a foreign policy professional and member of the Council on Foreign Relations, then makes a misleading distinction between NATO and the hopelessly ineffective United Nations. Presumably, he is unaware that the former NATO operates within the framework of and is subservient to the latter as a regional arm of the United Nations. As I have emphasized to you repeatedly, as I have documented on the air, reading to you from the law, from the treaties, from the United Nations Charter, from the NATO Charter, from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization Charter, the regional security agency known as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, was formed pursuant to Chapter 7, Article 52 of the United Nations Charter. In addition, Article 53 states, quote, the Security Council shall, where appropriate, utilize such regional arrangements or agencies for enforcement action under its authority, but no enforcement action shall be taken under regional arrangements or by regional agencies without the authorization of the United Nations Security Council. That's why Article 6 of the Dayton Peace Agreement stipulates that, quote, the United Nations Security Council will establish IFOR, the NATO force in Bosnia, acting under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. So behind Charles Krauthammer's back, the United Nations Security Council gets to decide if and when it wishes to use regional agencies like NATO and its American troops, and if it so chooses, it will use them under its authority. You see, you've been taken for a ride. When Bill Clinton lied to the American people and said we were sending troops under NATO, not under the United Nations, and that they would only be there for 1 year, he blatantly not lied. He lied. He knew that he lied. He did it intentionally. They are under United Nations command, and the Dayton Agreement specified 5 years, not one. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Please pull the wool out from over your eyes. Stop being sheeple and become real people. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. I'm going to go to the hospital. This is the voice of freedom, Eager Arizona.